The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. And on this week's program, we are taking a look at the behind-the-scenes struggles of the smartphone industry. It may look shiny from the outside, but scratch that surface and you quickly discover a mire of litigation that could have serious implications for users and the UK's development sector. We're also investigating a shadow internet network promoted and distributed by the US that ostensibly delivers unadulterated and unobfuscated freedom of information to countries with communication crackdown regimes. Is the US trying to own the web? And how much does using the web affect our brains? In a field light on research evidence but heavy on the rhetoric, there's another study to fuel the flames of public discourse. Joining me to debate these issues and more are digital media correspondent Jemima Kish and technology editor Charles Arthur and one of The Guardian's senior software engineers, Dan Catt. Welcome to the pod. Dan, how are you? This is your first time in the Starship Enterprise. What do you
Fresh
think?
Fresh meat.
It's very exciting. I've seen this, you're recording from outside. We have a glass window along one side, so I look in, so I thought I'd pop in. Say hello.
It's I've never spotted you abseiling past the glass window, but you know it can be done, I guess.
It feels a bit like multicolored swap shop.
It also feels a little bit like delicious. It's very well branded with the black and the blue and the white. Now, Jemima, we cannot help but nod to the biggest news story of the month, the remarkable Hackgate story. It's interesting this time around because, you know, most other stories, there's a lot of analysis saying Twitter broke the story, Twitter did this, you know, Facebook, internet, done stuff. This time around, it's very much, you know, Twitter follows the story. This is how Facebook has watched this unfold. What's your favorite technology-related story of Hackgate?
Not a technology story specifically, but my favorite little sort of bubble from the technology world is really the meteoric rise of Tom Watson, who, as you know, is minister, digital minister or something along those lines.
And friend of the pod as
well. I was just about to say friend of the pod, who has tenaciously pursued this story from the beginning. And because he's so active on Twitter, he feels much more visible and much more active than a lot of other people in Parliament. And so to see him really, really push this story for years now and finally get some credit where he was sort of ridiculed and dismissed out of hand has been fantastic. So good on him.
We look forward to speaking with him again in the studio as all of this starts to settle down.
Well, Charles, if it does.
Yes, indeed. Well, I can't imagine. I cannot imagine that it can continue at such a pace forever, lest the entire world of journalism is hacked apart, literally hacked apart.
Implodes, yeah. Reporting on itself so closely that there's nothing left for any other.
Charles, what's your briefly, what's your favourite technology story out of this? Is it the Lulzsec
hacks? Well, I think actually at the moment it's the Lulzsec hacks of News International, which happened on Monday night, which are intriguing because it suggests that, you know, okay, so Lulzsec, they said they were disbanding, nothing of the sort. But I think it's interesting that they share the affronted feeling that so many people have about the milli-dollar voicemails. The fact that it affects people in anonymous as well, I think, is intriguing.
Also on the programme this week, as Develop, the UK's largest games conference, kicks off in Brighton, Charles speaks with the man behind one of the top three social gaming companies in the world about surefire ways that game developers can corner this lucrative market. And finally, over the summer, we'll be thinking about our podcasts here at The Guardian, making sure that we are producing the best possible shows for you, our audience. We want you to get involved in this process too. So send us an email to techweekly@guardian.co.uk and we'll be in touch in the next couple of weeks with a few simple questions. Whew, quite a lot of information. Join us for the next 30 minutes of news and analysis on Tech Weekly from The Guardian. There's a serious storm brewing behind the shiny facade of the smartphone industry. Several important patent infringement investigations have been or are about to be decided by international tribunals, potentially forcing some smartphone handset makers out of the market and potentially destroying the business models of the burgeoning independent developer scene. Charles, this is quite a big story, and it seems to what we're seeing is really the tip of quite a monumental iceberg of what's brewing behind the smartphone market. What's happening?
there are two elements to it. First of all, you have companies suing other companies, as in large companies. So there's been the case where Nokia was suing Apple for a long time. Apple was countersuing Nokia. They settled that with Apple doing a cross-licensing deal for a number of patents with Nokia and Apple paying Nokia a certain amount of money. Microsoft sued HTC, saying that Android infringed various patents and that for HTC to build Android handsets meant that it was infringing Microsoft patents. HTC paid them. Microsoft has now gone to Samsung, is demanding around $15 a handset. The expectation it will be beaten down a bit on that, but it's still, you know, money changing hands. Now, Apple has won a patent ruling against HTC, saying that the HTC Android handsets, again, infringe a number of patents. And the two patents that it's said to infringe are really things that any Android handset does. There's one which is when, for example, you get an email or you get a phone number, if you press on it with your finger, then that will go and activate, for example, making a phone call or going to the email program. People say, yeah, but that's so totally obvious, except that Apple actually filed for it back in 1994 and 96 for these two relevant patents. And in those days, it was to do with text on a computer screen. And the idea was that Apple instituted something called data detectors, which said, hey, this looks like a phone number. If you click on it, then you can do something with it, which actually you still find now in the latest versions of OS X, Apple's operating system for desktop. So, you know, it's not exactly as if, you know, the fact that it's smartphones means that it's therefore somehow not relevant. It's an idea which has been, you know, which Apple basically implemented and they got the patent on.
It sounds to me like what's happening here is that it's real validation for R&D departments, ultimately, because what we're doing or what's happening is people enacting litigation based on stuff that was built, developed in R&D departments 5-10 years ago, but primarily...
Oh, even five, this is 15-16.
Yeah. But primarily even in Apple as well. I mean, is Android the main culprit here? Are they the ones who are coming out and saying, well, we're open source and so therefore, man, all, you know, it should all be open source? Or is it just simple accidental stumbling into something that they didn't
realize? In this case, in the big companies suing big companies thing, Android is the one that's being targeted because Google has not been around for so long. You know, in 94, it wasn't even thought of. I don't think Page and Brin had even met. But that means that Google and Android, therefore, don't have as many patents filed. They can't rely on as many pieces of intellectual property to defend themselves. Because often in these cases, what happens is that company A being sued by company B will say, yeah, well, actually, you infringed some of our patents. So, you know, let's just do a cross-licensing deal and call it quits.
And thus the importance, as we were talking a couple of weeks ago, about the patent deal for the companies that are going bust, that Google had started to bid ridiculous numeric jokes,
Which would have been a fantastic defensive patent collection for Google to have to use with Android, but it didn't go up to the money. I still don't understand why it didn't use more of its cash to do that. The other thing that's going on with patents is that you have companies which are colloquially called patent trolls, and they've gained ownership of patents which have been filed and which are, you know, registered in the US, and they then go after small software developers, independent software developers, and say, hey, you infringe our patent, therefore we want some money from you. You know, it's the same thing as the big companies do to the big companies, it's the small companies doing to small companies. The difference is the independent developers don't have the sort of money to get lawyers, they don't really have the money to actually pay the patent owner. So they say, what the hell, I'll just withdraw. So there have been examples of UK developers just withdrawing from the US market.
Jemima, which apps are under threat in this space?
Well, there's been quite a few developers tweeting about this. Charles mentioned Simon Maddox in a piece earlier. He said, all my apps have been removed from the US app stores on all platforms. And then he said, 0.575% of total revenue put in a spare bank account, screw you, Lodsys. And I asked him what that percentage equates to, and he said that's what Lodsys are asking for as a licensing deal. But this is really, really bad news. I mean, you're just getting this really exciting, creative ecosystem where app developers are really now starting to get quite sophisticated and really working out what works and what sells. But obviously, the more successful the app, the more successful the business, the bigger target they are for these trolls. It's really depressing.
Dan, what do you think that this will actually do to the apps ecosystem? Are there other places where people can publish their apps that are viable to actually making some cash in the market?
I think it's troubling in that as soon as you publish it somewhere else and it becomes big enough, then you become a target. As a developer myself, I'd be really worried about making something new, because these apps that people are making are using standard things from the SDK on the phone. So they're like, do you want to use this ability that's built into the phone? You say yes, and you assume you're allowed to use it because it's there. And next thing you know, you're getting sued for a patent for it, where that seems to be Apple. I mean, Apple is supposed to be stepping in defending these developers, but it doesn't seem to be happening fast enough. And I think I would be worried about developing something and putting it anywhere at the moment.
Charles. I mean, as a developer, how do you know whether you're infringing?
Well, exactly. I mean, I like the idea of patents. If I have an idea that's unique and I figured out, then I would want to be able to protect that and be able to make money off it, which these people did 15 years ago. But now it's an obvious thing. You know, 15 years ago it was something new, now it's an obvious. So I have to then worry that anything that I do that seems obvious is bound to have been patented sometime in the past, and I have no way of knowing.
Look at this retroactive patent claim from this Mumbai company called Kutol. I looked at their website. It looks like something that was built in GeoCities, and it sort of intellectual property kind of credibility with them. And then you look at what their claim covers, and it says it covers core messaging, publication, and real-time searching. Basically, it covers anything in any app, and it's really difficult to see it as anything other than a land grab, which basically is a money grab.
Although, interestingly, I got an email today from Philip Dorrell, who has the website 1729.com, you can find it there, who says he's got possible prior art for the Kutol patent, which would invalidate it. He says that in 2000 he was developing an idea for an internet messaging system called Miski, and he's got a reference to a web page which has been captured by the Wayback Machine from February 2001, whereas the Kutol filing is, let me see, it is 2004 or so. So what he's saying is, 2005. Okay, even if the Kutol patent is actually awarded, which it looks likely to be, it could be challenged and invalidated on the basis that this guy has put up something which does the same sort of thing and published it on the web page before.
They've been uncootled.
So with this, I mean, obviously you can be dogmatic and you could go back and you can filter through this and you can use tools like the Wayback Machine. But most independent developers don't have the time or the money to do this. So, Charles, it seems that the patent trolls, they have developers cornered. So is there any way that they can be stopped?
There isn't a simple solution, to be honest, because you'd have to say, okay, we invalidate software patents. And the difficulty with that is you'd have to roll back loads of legislation. And there are arguments that some software patents are valid, that they have a sort of validation in the sense that, not that they encapsulate an idea, because you can't patent an idea, but that once you manifest them in something physical, then they actually do become an object, and therefore, you know, that it makes sense to have coverage for them. I mean, I think software patents as an idea isn't a great one, but rolling it back, really hard.
Dan, is this the end of a golden era? This particular golden era of development?
Yes. it's always the end of one and the start of another. I think it's a problem. I don't think it'll stop innovation. I don't think it'll stop developers, but I think they'll just be slightly more careful.
Read all about it on guardian.co.uk/technology. Also in this week's news, the U.S. State Department is supporting developers of technologies that will help create a stealth internet to be deployed in countries which have regimes with tight controls on freedom of information. Keeping with Hillary Clinton's stated objectives of keeping the web open for communication, the primarily wireless technologies, dubbed Internet in a Suitcase, create a local web with links to the global network. This week, the Iranian government announced that it was aware of this technology initiative, that it had been expecting it, and that they were taking measures to upset the U.S. program in order to maintain the security of information within their country. In fact, they even were talking about their intention to create a countrywide intranet unconnected to the rest of the globe in order to protect its citizens from inappropriate information. So, Jemima, how does this internet in a suitcase work?
there are various projects that the American government has been supporting in a number of ways. There are projects in Afghanistan where they use towers on protected military bases, and then they're effectively creating a sort of independent mobile network. And one of those has cost at least $50 million. So there's a lot of money going into this. There are other projects. This is quite funny. This is taken from the New York Times fascinating feature about this, where they said American diplomats are meeting with operatives who've been burying Chinese phones in the hills near the border with North Korea, so they can be dug up and then used to make furtive calls, which sounds a little bit more like Bond. And then there's the actual internet in the suitcase thing, which they described as it relies on a version of mesh network technology. So it transforms phones or PCs to create an invisible wireless web without a centralized hub. And they say, in other words, a voice picture or email message could hop directly between the modified wireless devices, each one acting as a mini cell tower.
So it's a little bit like my my Sonos music system.
It's a bit like going down to Tandy, buying the bits.
The mesh networking is the key to it, which is that you create a peer-to-peer network where there's no central peer, and you just pass the message on as it needs to be.
So, Dan, this is something that the U.S. is working towards in order to promote freedom of information, which is a central tenet of democracy. But this is in countries with regimes that have historically controlled the internet, or at least the information on the internet. How have people in these countries historically, or countries with tight control to access to the internet, how have they accessed it before?
Well, normally you have your bunch of hackers who set up different routers or different websites you can go to that just sort of filter through like a VPN or so on and so forth. And they've done it from grassroots. So they'll be saying, come to here, and then you can get out, like people getting through the Great Wall, of the Chinese firewall. So it's been very much from inside the country helping themselves and helping the people around them to get that information. This is a bit odd because this is like the US parachuting in access to the wide internet from outside, which from a technological point of view seems good. It's like, hey, crazy, you can connect to their mesh, and then that'll go via satellite to get out. But at the same time, it's kind of enforcing it onto the people, saying, it's like America coming and saying, we're going to give you freedom, we're going to help you. And that doesn't seem like the right way to do it to me. It seems a bit odd, particularly as America saying, we're going to give you freedom of information.
And in addition, the notion, Jemima, as you mentioned, they're spending quite a significant amount of money on this. Does this mean then that the U.S. has rooting rights, can watch and observe and censor information that it doesn't want?
This online? Is the thing: is this very convenient burqa, if you like, of sort of free, the mission of free information. And then what are they, what subversive means are they doing? Because that $50 million is coming from the Defense Department. This is all a militarily strategic mission. And I think quite questionable. And the internet is largely a Western creation with Western businesses and Western political motives, and Western kind of cultural expression of that, if you like. So do they need Facebook access in Iran? There are very many questions about this, not least, shouldn't there be an Iranian sort of Facebook rival? And obviously censorship and ill treatment of people who are campaigning for free speech is an extremely important issue, but I think there are much deeper questions to be asked about this kind of infiltration. I mean, how would we react if it was the other way around, if Iranians were coming and setting up alternative networks within the US? I think we'd put up with that.
The Homeland Security after them pretty quickly, actually.
Exactly.
I mean, it's all a soft power thing. This is the US using its military budget to do things in ways which don't involve dropping bombs on people, but they're looking to have something of the similar effect, or possibly even the more effect, as in the sort of winning hearts and minds by saying, hey, listen, it's the internet, it's whatever information
check your news feed.
And in addition, I read this morning that the US is also putting quite a lot of money into anti-propaganda technologies, looking for uses of the web for political propaganda, and whether it's in China or whether it's in Iran, the traditional alternative soft powers to the US. So this is, as you say, Charles, this is part of a larger strategy.
I think we could say what we've seen in the Middle East since the beginning of the year is that actually giving citizens access to more information tends to be useful to those citizens. I mean, hell, we've seen it in the UK as well.
And finally in the news this week, the results of a research study undertaken at Columbia University in New York revealed that Google and other technologies are reducing our cognitive burdens, acting as bins of information that we don't need to have on the tips of our tongues at any one time. Now, the research, led by psychologist Betsy Sparrow, found that Google users are relying less on their own memories and more on the network to access information that would otherwise be trivial. So we're less demanding of our transitive memory, freeing up valuable headroom for things other than friends' phone numbers or the year that Henry VIII ascended to the throne. Charles, what was the study? What did they do?
Okay, the study, which is published in Science, the venerable Science magazine, had two people split into two groups. One, they were given pieces of information to type into a computer. Half were told it would retain the information, the other half were told it would be erased, which must have made them question why they were doing it. And then the ones who, some of the participants didn't make the effort to remember what was going to happen, if they thought they could look it up later. But when they were given information such as folder names to store, they got better at doing those. So the outcome basically is that if you think the machine's going to record it for you, you don't bother to remember it.
This doesn't particularly, Jemima, seem... it's an interesting study because, you know, it's transitive memory and the internet. But surely we've been thinking about these things since the pen was invented and we wrote things down in lists or used our mobile phones to hold on to our friends' phone numbers.
Yeah, I mean, down, right back to cave paintings. These are all ways to remember, some in more factual ways, others in more sort of imaginative ways to do with our culture and stories and history. But we recently had a talk at The Guardian from Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, who is an author and a professor at the Oxford Internet Institute, and he's just written a book about this exact thing, and there are many overlaps with this study. It was called Delete, the Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age. And he pointed out that there are 2.5 billion Google searches every day, and that for the past 10 years, Google has recorded everything you've ever searched for as one example of how information about us is archived. But do we need to remember that much information? And he's got these brilliant examples, like Andrew Feldmahl was an academic who wrote a paper a few years ago in which he detailed taking drugs in the 60s. And he was Googled at immigration, American immigration. They found it, found that he'd taken drugs, and now he's barred from the US. Victor's sort of cultural point about this is that this kind of technology means that we're not able to forget, and that means we're not able to forgive. And there is a built-in physiological need for us to be able to forget.
Now, Dan, you've got an interesting perspective, though, on what technology can do to support, for example, issues with memory retention.
I have this, as we record. There's this idea of the different type of things we need to remember. So things like telephone numbers, we don't. But as we store more and more stuff into Twitter and like upload photos to Flickr and Instagram, then there's this reinforcement all the time as well. So everyone's living very much in the now, but there's more services popping up saying, this is what you tweeted 1 year ago, and this is the photo you took a year ago, and then 2 years ago, and then 5 years ago. And as we build up that corpus, it's getting harder to forget about these things, and I'm interested in if that's rewiring our brains to be able to not forget. So for in this case of my children, who are like 9, their second and third birthday, they're reinforced on a weekly basis that they've had that. So that memory seems to be constant with them, whereas I can't remember those things. I remember one photo taken of it. So I can observe, this is anecdotal, that their memory is working in a different way to the way that my memory does. And I think as they grow up, they will have a harder time forgetting these events of which we've recorded, so photos and so on and so forth.
This is a really important point, that actually our memories are designed to be selective. We need to be able to not remember everything because it's too overwhelming. So we have to be more selective. And there's an idea that perhaps expiration dates being built into the information as we put it online would make this more helpful, because there's a big archive of information in there. We're never going to have time to look through it all again. And wouldn't it just be much more efficient and sensible if we thought about the information we put online and were more selective about it.
And on that note, you can read up on these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology.
In our massive archive.
Yeah. Let us be your bin.
The expiration date, we'll set it later.
Nintendo, Microsoft, and Sony may still hold the major game world headlines, but over the last 5 or so years, a new gaming industry has really swept the globe. Social games, from Farmville on Facebook to Words with Friends on phones, they're giving the boys a run for their money. And they're spawning a whole ecosystem of independent developers and publishing platforms for maximum innovation. At this week's Develop Conference in Brighton, the Evolve stream will tackle the business models and the best practices for indie developers and the old hands to get into this incredibly lucrative scene. One of the top social gaming platforms online is BigPoint. It's a free-to-play company that does online games playable by many people at once in a browser. In the run-up to Develop, Charles spoke with Philip Reisberger of BigPoint and asked him about how the company works with different social networks.
BigPoint is not just a development company or just a publishing company, so we have all of the infrastructure that is needed for that. And we regard Facebook or social networks in general as a traffic source on one side. So we are in every major social network you can imagine, like Naja Klaja or whatever there is, the Studio VZ in Germany. And with Facebook, it's a little bit of a different approach because in the past, it used to be the only network we were not really in. But we were buying traffic from Facebook as well.
How are you doing that?
Well, via banners and stuff like that. And linking,
adverts, basically.
Yes. But we have our first games being released on Facebook as well as games that are just for Facebook. One of it is called Toon Racer, which is a racing title in Unity.
How do you compete then with people like Zynga, who are famous with Farmville for being part of the Facebook estate almost? Yes. So the people thought they were the same thing.
Absolutely. There's one major difference which Zynga still... Actually, there are two major differences which Zynga still has to learn. Or one of it is to be successful outside of Facebook, because what they have, and that's the Facebook... good part about Facebook and the bad part about Facebook, it's a pretty harmonized world where you have... One approach fits all things. So if you get a user, you get all of them. On the other side, you still have to learn how to succeed outside of Facebook. And that's what we basically have done, because what BigPoint did in the past 6-7 years, we built up a media partner network of over 1,000 media partners worldwide, how we distribute our content and get users in. And no one else has achieved that yet.
Though, like Zynga, you also look to get revenue from your players. One of the interesting things that's come out of the Zynga IPO filing is that it gets revenues, that the vast majority of its revenues come from about 1% of its players, and that 90% never spend anything. So you have the sort of 1% of what they call the whales, 9% who are spending a little bit, and 90% who never open their wallets. How does it look for you? What's the sort of breakdown for you?
I won't reveal in detail, but the direction it's going is pretty much the same as pretty comparable, a little bit different because our audience is not as casual as a Zynga audience, and includes people playing in one world that have different backgrounds, different incentives. One is the people that have a lot of time but not so much money, like the students or pupils or whatever that is. And the other part are people like us working long hours, having a little bit more money but not so much time. And I think the main challenge of a successful business model, of really being successful in free-to-play, is combining these, like having these two people playing in one world.
What about the sort of problems that World of Warcraft has seen, where you have people, the gold mining sort of thing, where people effectively create side economies to help advance other people and have a sort of industry going there, which lies outside its terms of service. Do you see any of that happening with your games? And if you do, is it something you try to stop, or is it actually healthy because it indicates that there's a lot of eagerness to play the games?
Once you have an in-game economy, like Castronova described and all the others, I think in Ultima Online, that's when I first started, that is something where you always have the problem of people trying to abuse the system or utilize whatever it's out of the system. I think it really shows that people, if people start doing that, you do have a game that people care about. So that's a good part about that. The bad part about that, especially combining it with a free-to-play model where you don't pay for time, but you really pay for items and stuff like that, it becomes a lot more crucial to be on top of it and manage it. But we have our countermeasures to it, and parts of that is our currency system, that we don't have just one main currency, but we have a real currency, a virtual currency, and other meta currencies in place as well. And, which is very, very important, since the people that are playing the game and not abusing it might identify these bots, for example, or script users, give them an incentive to kill these bots, and they have a self-cleaning system.
What do you think are the most interesting things happening at the moment with online games like yours, browser-based games like yours?
What I'm seeing right now is my grandma's 83 years old, still very active, and she plays 2 hours every night. So what we're seeing now is we have a lot of people who have never played before, thanks to Zynga and Facebook and others, who really become avid gamers. So the first trend really is it's becoming a mass market. Everyone is playing and everyone is loving it. So we are educating people to play. And the other thing really is that it goes away from just creativity and having fun things, but having fun things and understanding why.
You mentioned, I've got to ask, what is the game your grandmother plays for 2 hours a day?
Oh, well, she doesn't play our shooting games and stuff like that, but she's more into the typical PopCaps type of games.
Okay.
So she's very casual. But she's good at it. She's better than I am, actually. That scares me a little bit.
So in 5 years' time, where do you see the online games industry being? You know, is it going to be like now, only a bit bigger, or is it actually going to have displaced other sorts of games activity, say the packaged games that you see in stores and things?
If we're not already, I think we as the games industry will be bigger than the music and the films industry combined. So just taking this momentum, it's going to be huge, whatever it is. And yes, if the console is dead, we're talking about this as a question, if consoles are the main market driver in a few years' time, or maybe the free-to-play model with no downloads, I think that's going to be where the driver is. But what's going to provide the most growth in this industry really is educating these so-called non-gamers 1 or 2 years ago that had no idea that they are playing games, and then started with Farmville and other games, and maybe in a few years' time they will be the ones wanting to have a unique Call of Duty experience as well.
Philip Reisberger of Big Point. We'll have more gaming news next week with reports from the Develop Floor, thanks to The Guardian's Keith Stewart. Keep up all week at guardian.co.uk/games. That's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Jemima, Charles, and Dan. Next week, we're reporting from Develop. See all the links from this program at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. The producer this week was Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratosky. And as so many of you have requested, see you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.